It's so easy to fall into the trap of looking sideways, you know, of comparing ourselves to other parents, comparing our kids to other kids, then signing up for a bunch of stuff that takes a lot of time and commitment. And you find yourself asking eventually, like, why are we doing all this stuff?
Welcome to Backseat Driver, the podcast hosted by two practicing psychotherapists, where we boil down years of experience with clients young and old to teach you how to do the what to do to improve your life and relationships.
I'm Mark Yamada, clinical psychologist in Seattle.
And I'm Nikki Bennett, licensed clinical social worker in Salt Lake City.
By simplifying and organizing your life to truly include what is essential, eliminating what is not, you can create a life that is built around meaning and purpose. It's not easy to let go of things that are good, but doing so will help you hang on to things that are better. In our show today, we'll be talking with Anna McEwen about essentialism. Anna is an accomplished actress. She's also the wife of Greg McEwen, the author of the New York Times bestseller, Essentialism, The Disciplined Pursuit of Less. We're going to get this wonderful backstage view of essentialism and how she has contributed to the development of this movement.
I grew up in Washington State. It was a great place to grow up, middle of five kids. In university, I decided to pursue a degree in music, dance, theater, which is its own kind of essentialist story. We can talk about that later if you want. And while there, I auditioned for the national tour of Beauty and the Beast, of the Broadway show of Disney's Beauty and the Beast, and joined that tour for about a year. It all sounds very, this happened and then that happened and then great. And it wasn't like that at all. Not at all.
You weren't just part of the tour. Weren't you Belle?
I was technically the understudy. And so most nights I was in the company, and then I did have the great privilege of opening as Belle in Austin, Texas. And our regular Belle was getting married, and she left for a couple weeks. And so that was really wonderful. So yeah, I can claim in some sense that I was Belle on tour. Though I do like to be honest about that technicality, that I was the understudy.
That's pretty incredible. What was that like, being a part of that?
It was incredible. It was a wonderful experience. I love what I do or did, and it's such a happy show. So that's really easy to find the joy in that every night, and to see children and families just delighted every night with the show. And it's just such an uplifting show. I love the character of Belle, and so that aspect of it was just a delight. And then the cast was varied and wonderful and supportive and a great group of people. And so, yeah, it was, I mean, living on the road is its own kind of challenge. You really learn what you miss, things you totally took for granted, like a refrigerator or a bookshelf, or a place to put your clothes that isn't in a suitcase, but, or having food on hand to eat. But, it was amazing. We traveled all over the country and a few places in Canada. Greg joined me. We got married while I was on tour. And
wow.
So he spent a good portion of our first year of marriage on tour with me, and was so supportive and put his life on hold to some degree, although Greg doesn't really put anything on hold. So he was working and brainstorming and writing and those kinds of things, and even worked in merchandise on tour. Greg and I met at college, and we've been married about 20 years now. And so that's a huge part of my story, is our marriage, our children. After tour, we went back and finished school and decided to start a family, which there was like a little bump along the way. Actually, when we were on tour, the plan was that we'd be on tour about a year, and hopefully I'd get pregnant at the end of tour, and that would be like a great segue to leave and go back to school. And I technically did get pregnant, but that was a real interesting journey because I had health insurance through the show, through Actors Equity, which is really fantastic, thankfully. But finding a doctor who would see me was a real challenge because we weren't in the cities more than, on average, we were in a city about 2 weeks, and
oh, wow.
Sometimes just 1 week. And so I was pregnant and was feeling really not well. And I had the typical morning sickness, I guess you could say, but having been pregnant since then, it was pretty severe. I felt like I was seasick almost all the time. And then I started spotting, and I just didn't know what was happening with this pregnancy. Was it okay? Was that normal? This was my first pregnancy. I really wanted to see a doctor. No one had any appointments. No one was interested in seeing me because I wouldn't be a long-term patient. And then one day during a rehearsal, I bled a lot, and it was kind of crisis mode for me. And thankfully it was in Washington, DC. We were going to be there about a month, and I had a friend there, and she's like, I can get you into my doctor. Let me just call and tell them. And so thankfully this doctor saw me, and, through the examination, it was, you know, right on the verge of when you'd hear a heartbeat. And she's like, well, just cause I can't hear anything doesn't mean anything, you know, let's get an ultrasound. And, we found out that day that, that my pregnancy was something really quite rare called a molar pregnancy, and that a baby hadn't formed. It was more like clusters of tissue. And this wouldn't resolve on itself, that I'd need to have a procedure, that it is technically, it can be precancerous. So you need to be monitored for like 6 months to a year, and you really should not get pregnant during that time, because with a molar pregnancy, I'm probably giving you too much detail here, too much information.
No, but, this is great.
But my HCG levels, which is the pregnancy hormone, were off the charts. And that is an indicator of a molar pregnancy. And so they have to monitor that for months until it gets back down to like almost zero. And you need to stay at that level because if a growth recurs, it can recur somewhere else in your body, and the HCG hormone will go up. So that was a bummer. We were excited about starting a family. We were excited about having kids. And not only was this pregnancy not going to produce a sweet little baby at the end of it, but we'd have to wait, which doesn't sound like that long, but when you're in the middle of it, it feels like forever.
I can imagine. I've had several miscarriages myself, and even the 3 months seemed difficult.
Right? Yeah.
I'm so sorry you went through that. It's awful.
Oh, well, it was definitely a growing experience, and I had a lot of support and was really grateful for my friend, for that doctor, of course, for Greg. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah. Yeah.
And
so,
you've had how many children now?
We have four. Yeah. Four kids. Our first two were really close together. Happy surprise there. They're like 18 months apart. So
wow.
When my first one was 9 months old, that's when I got pregnant. And a couple months later, I'm like, I am so tired. I think I have mono or something. I don't know what's going on. Yeah. So surprise.
Well, tell our listeners about this concept around essentialism and where it came from.
Oh, well, you know, as with all concepts, these things are many years in the making, but, and Greg would have a very, he's just so articulate and, you know, he talks about this all the time, but I'll do my best. Essentialism was probably, I mean, it was born when we lived in Silicon Valley. And, if anyone has live there, if you know about it, the culture there is really, really fast paced. It's really expensive to live there. It feels like everyone is working around the clock to get ahead, even just to survive. There's lots of alpha personalities, super capable people. I remember attending a back to school night, an elementary school back to school night, when some parents were asking why homework wasn't starting sooner. And I was like, wow, this is intense. And you know, a lot is accomplished. It's super productive, but it is definitely a fast paced place to live. And add to that, we had an experience where I was giving birth to one of our children, and Greg, he was really stressed the whole time I was in labor. I was induced for this child. She was super late. And so thankfully I could talk. It wasn't like my labors are really long. So we could talk through it while we were in the hospital. And he was really stressed about a meeting he felt he needed to go to, which would be the next day. And you know, even though we're in the hospital, I'm giving birth to one of our kids. He just didn't know what to do. And you know, I could have said, don't go. Why are you going? But, you know, we're both in this culture. We're both, I don't know, by this point, those things can kind of seep into how you do things, become habitual. And I wanted him to decide to be with me. I know that probably sounds silly. And if I'd been more, more open and honest, I think we would have come to a better decision together, but.
Well, it sounds human to me. I mean, I can think of so many times in my life where I think, just do the right thing. Don't make me have to tell you, or it doesn't mean as much.
Yeah. I was definitely grappling with those feelings for sure. And I also didn't want to hold him back. If this was super important, I didn't want to get in the way of something that was really important and could lead to good things, you know? You know, we needed him to be successful. We weren't smooth sailing. And so he went, and that, as he thought about that later, and as we talked about that later, this idea that he'd been pondering for years, he'd been researching for years about how doing less can actually bring greater results because you have better focus, kind of culminated in this story. It was a real evidence of getting it wrong and of what we needed to change. And so you could call that kind of the birth of essentialism.
Did he make it back for the baby's actual birth?
He was there for the birth. So we had we actually, the baby was born and then he went to the meeting.
Oh gosh. Okay.
But then he came back after the meeting, but yeah. So
okay.
How
is essentialism the same or different from that really popular minimalism movement that you hear so much about these days?
That's a great question. I would say it's similar in that both are seeking a simpler way of doing things, a simpler life, less complicated. But essentialism is different in that it puts the emphasis on discerning what is essential in our lives. And often that's prioritizing things like relationships and people and contributing, you know, our own personal contribution. That can include, of course, professional pursuits. But it's making sure that as we get rid of things in our life, we are not getting rid of what's most important, that the things we focus on are the most important things in our lives.
That's a really good point, because as I think of Marie Kondo, for instance, I went through this year of getting organized where I was like, I'm going to touch every single thing in my house. And when I look back, I think, yes, I got a lot accomplished. However, at what cost? That took hours and hours and hours of work that I wasn't doing the essential things around being with my family. And that's interesting.
Yeah, I think we've all done that at some point. I mean, that's such a human experience. Like you were saying, you know, we make these trade-offs. We don't realize that they're having an impact. And then we look back and we're like, okay, I wish I would have done something different there.
Yeah. So essentialism really sounds like just living life with intention everything you do with intention.
Yes. How, yeah, that's a good
summary. How do you get clear on that? Because there are so many people, I think, that aren't clear, or that fool themselves into thinking, well, I am actually doing the most important thing. I'm providing a living for my family because they're the most important thing. But then they somehow, you know, you always hear or see in the movies the story of somebody tragically on their deathbed thinking, oh, nobody at my, you know, in my career is here to support me. And I really missed the mark here. How does one get clear on that?
There's a quote that has stuck with me, and I think it really answers that question. And it talks about discernment. And it says, when trying to discern what is and is not essential, remember to listen carefully, edit brutally, and never underestimate the power of sleep, play, and making time and space to escape. In time, you will not only find yourself closer to becoming an essentialist, but also experiencing greater joy in the journey. So for me, one of the main things is creating space for myself so that I can get perspective. I think loss of perspective is a real culprit in why we're not essentialists. Yeah.
I'm so glad to hear you say that, because Anna, I run into that almost every day with clients that I work with, where they get stuck and they don't realize that they believe everything they're doing is essential. And then look at it as, but I'm stuck because there isn't enough time in the day. So this more refined way of trying to determine what is important versus what is truly essential to happiness, and things that from the deathbed looking back, you won't regret having spent your time on, that Nikki was referring to. That I think is a really, really hard thing for people to decide, that they're holding on with one hand to something and they go, this is so important, and they can explain why, then they're holding on with their other hand. And now they've got two things they're holding on to, and now they're stuck and can't move.
Absolutely. Yeah, we give up our power of choice with loss of perspective and overwhelm. And once that's restored, we begin to realize, I have a choice here. I don't have to do things this way.
That sounds so scary at times to go, okay, I know what I think I should do, but I'm so scared to let this go as non-essential, because I think a lot of people will focus on all the things that won't happen more so than all the things that would if you let go.
Yeah, absolutely. And culture is so strong. Like it's so easy as a mom to fall into the trap of looking sideways, you know, of comparing ourselves to other parents, comparing our kids to other kids, then signing up for a bunch of stuff that takes a lot of time and commitment. And you find yourself asking eventually, like, why are we doing all this stuff? Like you said, we get afraid of what's not going to happen. And I think fear, if I can identify it, I've begun to really want to face it, because fear is really nasty. It really holds us back, holds me back. And I've realized in recent years, it's played more of a part in my life than I even realized and was aware of. And coming face to face with that is a step toward, for me, toward being more free, toward going, okay, really, what am I scared of? Am I scared my kids aren't going to get into college if they aren't incredible athletes? Is that what I'm afraid of? Do we have to do all of these sports? And now, you know, with that being such a competitive thing, you feel like, oh, my kid didn't start at 4 years old. They're doomed, you know, or if they're not on I can't remember the name of it, but those teams that travel around.
Select teams that are kind of junior pro.
Yeah. And I've definitely lived in areas where those things are highly emphasized, and that's what everyone's doing. And so you're like, oh, I'm afraid that if my kid's not doing this, that they're missing out, or it's going to affect their future somehow. And really coming to terms with those things and listening to that voice inside is scary. I think it is scary.
One of the reasons I wanted to have you on our show, when I reached out last summer, it was that I've watched you from afar over these past, I don't know how old your oldest child, 15 years or so.
My oldest is 18.
Oh my goodness.
What?
Time goes fast. So
it does.
I've kind of watched you from afar, you know, via blog or social media. And I just had such an admiration for you as somebody, even before Essentialism, who really seemed to just have it figured out. I mean, truly, like watching you raise chickens and watching you go through the green smoothie phase with your kids and watching you get a horse and try that out. I just see you as someone, and again, like we can only see so much in social media, right? But I think,
sure,
you know, once I came across Essentialism, it was like, oh no, she really does walk the walk. I'm somebody who feels those same fears you talk about. Like, oh, I mean, the other night I woke up in the middle of the night and I'm like, oh no, Jack is six and I haven't put him in a single sport other than swimming. He's a has-been already. Like, he's not going to have friends and he's not going to be confident and he's not going to know how to be a part of a team. And especially where I live in Salt Lake, I think there's just such a, my second son actually got kicked off of an elite team when he was like 4 years old, not 6 years old, I think. Anyway.
Oh my goodness. That's insane.
Oh yeah. And how much you would worry about that, where you look at all the neighbors and go, oh my goodness, my little guy, he's starting out first grade already behind.
Yes, completely. And so I wonder, with me, it seems as though I'm constantly, explain it as like running in this hamster wheel of, when I get ABCD done, then I'll slow down and enjoy the important things in life, enjoy my kids. And, but first I need to organize and I need to do their baby books and I need to take care of
baby
all
books.
These things.
Yeah.
Tell me how you do that. How do you create that space that you talked about to figure out
Gosh, that's a good question. I mean, let me just be really honest. I mean, I do not do a lot of stuff and I've struggled with the guilt. I mean, the baby books, I managed to do a baby book one through like birth through 2 years old a few years ago. That is as far as I've got. I have these massive boxes that I just put all their memories in and hope that someday we'll sit down together and go through that. My kids are not on elite athletic teams. We decided to homeschool in middle school when my oldest started middle school. That was not an easy decision. It was up to her. And there are a lot of trade-offs with that. And the jury's still out. You know, we'll see. It takes a lot of, it takes some resolve when you feel that something is right to stick with it. And that's the story of homeschool. My youngest just started it this year. And with COVID, she's transitioning into middle school. She decided to go ahead. It's always up to the kids. And I don't know if she's going to stay with it. You know, we'll see. I don't know if this is really gonna be her cup of tea. It can be really isolating. And while my kids are super close and there are truly benefits to the choice we made, there are trade-offs and it is scary. And when I talk to other moms and they find out we homeschool, I think there is this tendency to go, wait, well, it's okay that I'm not doing that, right? You know, is my choice valid? Is my choice okay? Personally, it's really important to me to create space to make decisions that I feel conviction about.
I think I get what you're saying, which is that you've chosen to just live your life with intention. And that means you've had to give other things up. I'm curious if you can give us a better look into what some of those things are, because I know, and I feel so much guilt and shame over this. In fact, Mark and I have recorded an episode where we talk about screen time and my gross addiction. But I've known for the past decade and a half that it's something that gets in the way of me doing what is essential. The other thing that gets in the way for me is this obsession around recording memories, pictures, posting things on Instagram where I can put them into chat books. And I often have a thought that I'm so busy preserving memories for a future that I'm missing right now. I mean, I had two people really dear to me pass away this last year. And one of the two was, she's kind of been my motivating factor around preserving memories and being organized. And I think, gosh, she's not even here now to enjoy that future. How much of that am I giving up in the present moment? So I'm curious what some of the things that you feel like you have given up. I heard you say premier athletic teams, which I love because I haven't done that either. But I find that I take that space and then I fill it unintentionally with things like social media or just wasting time. Help me. Teach me all the ways.
Oh, gosh. I think what you're saying is your answer. You know, the just being self-aware is step one for me. It's going, is this bringing me stress? Is this making me frustrated? Am I shorter with the people around me? Or is this bringing me calm? Is this bringing me a feeling that I am living with purpose? I mean, it sounds so, I mean, it's not the nitty gritty. So day to day, there are days, many days where I feel like I didn't accomplish a thing, you know, and Greg will be like, you are so blind to what you're doing. And this is my personal challenge, I guess you could say, you know, but I'm going around from task to task and not even recognizing that loading the dishwasher takes time or folding that load of laundry took time. And it just feels so unimportant in ways, you know, that I can spend my day doing a ton of stuff and then feel like I didn't accomplish anything. And so becoming self-aware and really looking at how we spend our time, I feel like is the first step to, I don't know if taking control is the right phrase, or owning our life and owning that we can make different choices.
Yeah. I'm curious. It seems to me I have these crises, which we all do, but I'm better able to be essential and come back to what's important when I go through something difficult in my life. Like, I think of my first son had open heart surgery when he was 3, and that changed my whole perspective on everything in life and what was important. And each of those experiences as I go through life has continued to shape the person that I am becoming every day. And of course, boundaries are a huge part of that. And I want to get to that later, but I'm curious about what some of your life defining moments have been and how those have impacted you and your ability, or I guess willingness to live a more essential life.
Oh gosh, there's so many in life that during them, I just was, it was just so hard. You know, I was just struggling so hard throughout high school or college. I had these defining moments. Even choosing my major was a real step into the dark for me, because it just made no practical sense. I studied music, dance, theater. I am very practical. I want to, you know, have a path that makes sense ahead of me. And this was completely not that. And yet I felt I was doing the right thing. I knew that this was, I came to a point where that was clear to me. It wasn't like always clear to me, but there came a point where that was clear and I held on to that and I went forward with that. And so that was a very defining moment for me. And Greg had a similarly defining moment in his life when he quit law school and moved to America. And that has created a foundation for our approach to life, for our marriage. And recently, you know, I have a daughter, she's 16 now, and she came down with an undiagnosed illness. And this was a really defining moment for our family, a real period of growth for us. It was near the end of 2018. And she started having kind of these little tics. And I thought, well, she's a teenager. She was 14 at the time. And she's going through puberty. Maybe it has something to do with that. And she'd kind of quieted down a little, but nothing that was alarming to anyone. And then she was complaining of, like, we'd gone on a family trip where we walked around a lot, and she's like, my hips are achy, and when I stand, they hurt. And so I just took her to a physical therapist. And while she was there, he pulled me aside privately. And he's like, I don't want to alarm you, but I think there might be something neurological going on here. And she had some reflex tests that I just did, and she didn't respond normally, just to typical reflexes. And so I think it'd be a good idea just to see a neurologist, just to make sure, you know, everything is okay. Or anyway, so yeah, that caught my attention, and we were able to see a neurologist, the next day, but there was like nothing that the neurologist could really see, or, the reflex tests weren't as dramatic for her, or, you know. So, over the next 3 months, it was a lot of watching and waiting, and a lot of communication with the doctor, seeing different doctors. And essentially, she just started to go downhill. And the things that, like, the symptoms were, she had kind of she thinks was a seizure when she was in the shower. She felt like she was spinning and she hit her head on the wall. And then her right side of her body started to slow down. So it wasn't weaker, but it couldn't move as fast. So she played the piano and that was becoming severely impacted. She took over a minute to write her own name. And then she had a really big seizure one night, and that was really scary for all the kids, and of course myself. Greg was out of town, and the doctors, they were awesome. They ran every single test, they looked into every possibility, and every single test came back negative. She had so many blood tests. She had scans, MRIs, and EEGs, and nothing was telling us anything. Meanwhile, she's just getting worse and worse. And so, yeah, that was agony. But it was a really important time for our family and for Greg and I, as we watched this happening, as we did what was in our power, as we took her to appointment after appointment, and as we prayed. I mean, faith was a really important part of that period for us. I mean, faith is actually an important part for every period for us, but it really, you know, when the rubber hits the road in those moments, you're like, okay, you know,
we got
this needs to work for us, you know, and you put it to work and you're stretched. And one of the things that we essentialized was mental health. There's this talk about optimism by Gordon B. Hinckley, and we listened to that. Well, Greg, he's like, I am listening to this every day. Mm-hmm. And it was so helpful. The words in it, I mean, we'd listen to it as a family, or I just have it on in the background sometimes, so that the kids now, when they hear that quoted, it's like, they can say it with it, you know, certain quotes. It's just so familiar to them. And so, so being grateful, focusing on things to be grateful for, that was really, really good and helpful. My oldest daughter, Grace, would laugh and laugh with Eve, laugh about what she was struggling with. And at first we were a little like, is this okay? Is that okay? Is this, you know, this is really serious. Should we be laughing? You know? But it was actually really beautiful. And Grace would take, Eve and dance with her and get her moving, 'cause Eve couldn't move very well, and, put on some music and just, and make a fun experience just spontaneously in the kitchen. I remember watching that, and being so grateful because I couldn't do it myself. And these things, oh, and we reached out to our community. I mean, we were a little hesitant to do that. And this friend and mentor emailed me, and her kids are all grown, but she's like, one of my sons, well, two of her sons, I guess, had really life-threatening things. And one was leukemia as a child. And she said, we reached out to everyone and asked them to pray for us. And it made all the difference. And so we got vulnerable, and we just sent an email to pretty much everyone and explained a little bit of what was going on and asked for their faith and prayers. And that was really sustaining and beautiful, and to feel their support. Some wrote back just such supportive things that really, really helped us. So, I mean, you learn, in, like you said, in these moments of crisis, you learn what's really important. You learn how to find joy amidst hellish experiences. It just seems like impossible, but those moments are there if we open ourselves to them, if we look for them. I mean, I feel like gratitude is just so powerful. It is absolutely essential to our family and to our life is gratitude, and for our mental health. I mean,
I would agree completely. And I love both of those stories, and they're so different, but the first one I think illustrates the importance of listening to your heart. And also, you know, it requires boundaries around what are other people going to think, or what am I supposed to do? You know, this isn't the degree I'm supposed to pursue. And yet I feel called to it. I think it's so essential to have that kind of courage and to listen to your intuition. And in your second story, gosh, just, you know, I kept thinking of this checklist as you were going, like, of things that are essential. Yes, gratitude, optimism, faith. When you shared your story around prayer, it reminded me of when Parker had his open heart surgery. Of course, every listener out there knows that I struggle with anxiety, and he was my only child at the time, and I was having infertility and didn't know if I could have another child. And prayer is honestly what got me through it. I truly can say, you know, no, it doesn't always change the outcome. And yet for me, I felt strengthened by knowing that people across the United States that I didn't even know. And I loved how you said that does require such a degree of vulnerability, but the payoff is so great. So thank you for sharing those. I'm curious, how's Eve doing today?
Oh, she's doing really well. She's doing the best she's done in the last 2 years. We were able to see a specialist who immediately acted. He was like, okay, every test is negative, but this to me looks like something called autoimmune encephalitis. It's brain inflammation, and there are ways to treat it. Let's just try a round of steroids, see if she responds. And if she does, then let's do this further treatment. And we did, and it had an immediate impact. And she did regress, which was in its own way, a challenge because doctors, you know, your child, you know, their level of activity and personality and these things. And those were impacted. But if a stranger met her, they'd think, oh, this is just a normal, teenager child. She's good. And thankfully we were referred to a doctor who's like, she listened to us for 45 minutes, just taking notes. She's like, I just want to hear the whole thing from beginning to end from one person. Tell me everything. And she's like, yeah, parents know, they see, they observe, and let's do another round of treatment with this variant changed. So during COVID, Eve was admitted to the hospital for 5 days and had a thing called plasmapheresis, which is a little bit scary, but she's come out of it and is herself again. She's quirky. She's funny. She's silly. She's pushing herself again. It's good. I mean, there's still residual effects she has to work through and build back again, but we are very happy, very grateful.
Oh, I'm so glad. Congratulations.
Thank you.
That's a tough thing. I wanted to touch really quick, and I mentioned it earlier, on boundaries and how essential that is when you're trying to live your life with intention. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Because I know particularly with, you know, people that are close in your life, when you have to start doing the things that are essential, that means you cut out other things that are good and important.
Yeah, that's, you know, I think boundaries is, I don't know if everyone struggles with it, but I can say I struggle with boundaries, especially with self-care, in that I don't prioritize that or hadn't. And COVID has really been good for me to see how I wasn't doing that. With homeschooling and with a husband who works from home, and Greg and I have always worked and talked a lot about what he's working on. I've been a sounding board for sure. To that it's easy to go, these things are the most important things in my life: my children, their health, their well-being, my husband, his health and his success, and they're home with me all the time. And where is the space for me? And it just kind of crept up on me. And there are so many things that I've become aware of and had to work on. One being that I lost the ability to relax. Didn't even know how to do it. I don't know how to relax, you know? And so Greg's like, can you make a list of like 10 things that are just enjoyable, that like are fun for you, or that make you smile, that make you happy? And it was a really good exercise for me. They didn't just flow out of my pen. Some did. I was surprised by how many things were food related. but it got me thinking about things that I enjoy, so that I could begin to carve out time to self-care in that way. And something that surprised me was Greg would advocate for me at times, you know, okay, guys, leave mom alone, she's taking a bath or whatever. I'm going to do this thing. Okay, guys, you know, like just setting a little bit or giving a little bit of information about like why I'm going to be unavailable. And my kids were so supportive. Like they understood it. And that surprised me, that they could see that this would make mom healthy and this would help mom. So we can get behind that. And so that was really encouraging, for me with setting boundaries.
I love that. And it really is true, as silly as it seems, that you can't give what you don't have. And if you're not starting with taking care of yourself, you can't be there for everyone. Your story reminded me of, you know, and I hadn't really thought about this before, but your kids really do jump on board. My husband travels a lot, or did pre-COVID. And one night I was really stressed, having the two little ones and the two bigger ones. And I came down, and my Tanner at the time, I think, was 13. He had set out my yoga mat, my car keys, and my water bottle. And he said, "Mom, I know how important yoga is for you. I want you to go tonight and I'll clean the kitchen." And I thought, wow, they really do get it when we start setting those boundaries. They see the benefits of it.
Yeah, absolutely. That is such a great story. What a great kid.
So I got on to Greg's website and took the Essentialist quiz, and I actually did better than I thought. However, I still do have some areas where I need to refine myself. Mark, how did you do on that? I know you took it too.
Yeah, I found it very, very insightful and thought-provoking. I came out where there's some places that told me that I was well-intentioned and it gave me great encouragement and some guidance as to what I could do different or what to look at. And then there were some sections where it described me as a coaster, the coaster, where I'm busy, but it's not really directed at something long-term with great meaning and purpose. It's kind of busy work. And that I found was quite helpful because it's so hard sometimes as a human being, when you start doing something and you do it and you do it again and you do it so many times that it becomes habit, then our minds actually stop paying attention to that. And it did for me. So I'm just doing things that I think or assume are important. Otherwise, I wouldn't be doing them. But come to realize that it's important to stop and take a look and wake up and go, well, is that really that necessary? Yes, it is. And some things that I found, Anna, were there were some things that I was checking off my list, and checking them off the list, I became aware, actually became my purpose rather than what I was checking off. That's what taking the essentialist quiz did for me, was it just woke me up to looking at fulfillment and checking off lists. In the moment, I can fool myself to telling me that's the indication that I am on the right track. And as I was thinking about this, it really connected to many clients that I work with that are so busy and wrapped up in that whirlwind of this idea that becomes perhaps the American dream or creed of the more productive you are, the more you achieve and produce, the more you acquire and have, you know, the more fulfilled or the more successful a person is. And I realize and encourage people to really take a second look at that, that that's not necessarily the case. And let me share with you a story that popped up in my memories as I was listening to our discussion today. I once knew somebody who worked very hard and became very financially successful. And certainly it required that kind of investment of time and energy. But he was saying how pleased and proud he was of himself when I asked him what he had done over the weekend. And this was in summertime. And he said, well, I spent Saturday riding my Husqvarna, which is a brand of machinery, riding tractor lawnmower, and I mowed the backyard. And then I said, well, what'd you do on Sunday? Well, I spent Sunday riding my John Deere tractor mower, and I mowed the other yard. And as he was proudly telling me this, it really resonated for me that although he felt so proud and accomplished about himself for having such property and two riding tractor mowers, the thought came into my head that I asked him, whoa, you own a lot, or do your things own you?
Yeah.
Because it really hit me hard there and caused me to think things are there to be enjoyed and to help and to support and to give meaning and enjoyment, but not to the degree where they control or own my life, to where I spend this essential or time that you can't reclaim doing busy and important things that I think are busy and important, when ultimately, like Nikki, you were referring to, from the deathbed looking back, I don't want to live my life worrying and regretting that I didn't spend one more day in the office. or something like that, and really wanting to have it focus more on Anna, as you were describing, on relationships, I think it always comes down to, for human beings, and especially for me, at the end of the day, at the end of life, looking back, I don't want to regret that I didn't give my heart and soul to important people and cultivating relationships. And I don't want to regret that. So that's what the Essentialist test did for me, is it really showed me where I was doing well, but also encouraged me to take a look at some areas of refinement. And that's going to be my goal for this year, is to further refine and organize my life so that it has even clearer meaning and purpose to me. What about Nikki, for you? What insights did you gain from taking the quiz?
I guess, Anna, maybe you can help me with this one. I'm having a hard time putting this into words, but I think reading it and going through the questions, it was like, oh no, I would leave the office. I would do the email later. I would be present with my people. And yet I'm recognizing that a lot of times we trade one set of problems for another. So I think I did well on the test, and yet I continue to do things in my life without intention. One of the things I did recently was I got rid of Marco Polo, which was so hard. It's a communication app where you can leave videos for people. And it was really my great connection to a lot of friends and family, but it was eating so much of my time up. And I thought, well, no, I do it while I'm, you know, driving the car, or while I'm doing the laundry, or while I'm emptying the dishwasher. But now that I've gotten rid of it, I've found 30 to 60 minutes a day to practice the piano. And I've found that I'm meditating every day, and I'm enjoying little conversations with my kids while I'm folding the clothes instead of being on Marco Polo. So I think that there's always more honing in to do. And Anna, I so appreciate your time today, because I do see you as somebody I really admire and that does put the essential things in place. And like you, I would say mental health is so essential to me, and also just spreading this message out in the community. So thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
Do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners?
I think just on what you were saying, it's living an essentialist life is a process that we're all going to be working on our whole lives. I mean, what you said is true for me as well. I am still refining and still finding things that I can, you know, make a better trade-off or be more present. I think we're all aspiring essentialists. Greg just came out with a 21-day challenge on essentialism.com that just breaks things down nice and easy over 21 days, like little wins. If someone feels overwhelmed or wants a little bit of help to begin introducing the principles of essentialism in their life. And if you buy the paperback that just came out, it's free.
I love it. Thank you so much, Anna. I really appreciate your time. If you haven't, listeners, already checked out Greg's podcast, do that. Anna is a guest on a couple of the episodes, which is what made me say, I have got to talk to her. Mom to mom, woman to woman. So thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's called What's Essential. So thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And that's it for another Backseat Driver. If you found this podcast helpful, please share it with a friend.
We'd really appreciate it if you take a minute to rate and review our podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.